This is Why I Settled in Tasmania.
The life stories about people from refugee backgrounds living and building a new life in Tasmania.
Here on Hobart FM.
Why I Settled in Tasmania.
This program is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, CBF.
Welcome to Why I Settled in Tasmania. Hello, I am Sonia Parra, and today we are with Josette Massimo from South Sudan Community in Hobart, Tasmania.
After 50 years of conflict between the North and South, South Sudan declared with expectations and hopes their independence. It was July 2011. Now, 6 years later, the world's youngest country is living an internal conflict that has become a humanitarian crisis.
We are in the primary school in Hobart, where Joseph is teacher.
Before I came to Tasmania, I was living in a refugee camp in Uganda. My parents were originally from South Sudan, but because of the war that broke out since several wars happened in South Sudan, in Sudan by then, but after the independence, South Sudan became a nation.
Yes.
So my parents left South Sudan long, long time ago, before we were even born. They went into Uganda, a refugee camp, were born in Uganda, and we have lived in Uganda for quite a long time, for nearly 17 years in a refugee camp. Even if we were born in Uganda, we have no right to become a citizen in Uganda. So we remain as refugee in the camp. That had been my life before I came to Australia. So having lived in Uganda for 17 years as refugee, you can imagine. It was not an easy life. It was always a struggle, because a struggle to get something to eat, a struggle to make living, you know, a struggle to go to school because mom did not have money. So we have to work so much in a garden that some of what we planted, the crops we planted, can be sold, and that can be used to pay our school fee. That's pocket money to go to boarding schools. So basically, that was really the basic life.
But yes.
Even if it was a difficult life, we kept our hope alive for one day a better life. And so when my elder brother came here in 2001 from Kenya, but before he came to Australia, he spoke to me on a radio call that he has been successful in his application to come to Australia. So when
he was married in that time?
Yes, please. He was married in refugee camp in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came here in 2001, he was well received. He came probably, he was the biggest family that came to Tasmania.
How many
people? He was a family of 14. Some of the children are from the previous marriage. When he came here, he had the chance to call me. It wasn't easy because we didn't have phone. So when he arrived in Tasmania, he made a call back. It was always a struggle to even call someone to go and find you or any of the relative who might have mobile phone.
Yeah.
And he will direct say, can I talk to this person? Can you take him the phone? And, you know, we live in a village. He will just say, okay, I will call on such a time, like at 12.
Yes.
You know, and by that time, could you take the phone to my brother? So that's how we connect. And so he made a promise that he will send for me phone to apply to come to Australia.
That time you were in the refugee camp with your parents and more siblings, or
yes,
Yes. And how many brothers and sisters you have?
My mom got married before we were born to another man, but they divorced and then got married to my dad. She was the third wife for my father, the youngest, the third one. And yes, we are five in numbers.
Yes.
But then there are also brothers and sisters from the other wives.
Ah, okay. So how many are in total?
We're 12.
Can you tell us a little bit more in a context? How was your childhood in the refugee camp?
It wasn't easy. Life was, right from the beginning we were born, I was the last born to my mom. And so when dad and mom divorced or separated, you can imagine what kind of life we were going through. And mom as a single mother wasn't easy because she has to work even harder to be able to provide for us food on the table, to be able to send us to school. We grew up in a village, in a very simple life, and we have to walk like 20 kilometers away from home to go to school.
Every day?
Every day, whether it is raining or not. And that was the life we were in.
Okay.
Yes, I was 10 years old. So it was difficult because I guess back in Africa, a lot to do with it. There's not so much to do with the safety, or kids' safety. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, by that time, when I was 10, I couldn't walk 20 kilometers away to go to school and come back, you know. So life was not easy, but then we were born in such a life, in that kind of life. We didn't know whether there was any more better life somewhere than what the life we were in. So that's what we knew and the world we were in by then.
How is the pet's memory and the worst memory that you had of your childhood?
The bad memories was that when dad separated with my mom, he did not want to get in touch with us, even to see us.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult growing up seeing my mom struggle on her own because they divorced. Was very difficult. Even for us to know that dad has already moved on with his life. So that was the difficulty we were in. You know, as children, I guess children need both parents to be there for upbringing. Dad need to be, you know, some kind of role model for boys growing up.
Yes.
But we were missing that, you know. The school we went to was a difficult, you know, we didn't even have table or desks. We were sitting on a stone. And it was a rocky camp. So we have to provide, you know, our chairs by bringing a stone and we sit. You can imagine how hard it is. You can't even sit for 20 minutes. You have to get up and walk around because you're feeling now the heat, you know, you're not sitting very comfortable. So that was the bad memories. But the good thing for me, when I look back now, I think with that difficulties we grew up in, when I look back, I reflected on our life when we were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me so much energy. I begin to look far better. And I would say to myself, because of my background, with the difficulties we went through, I don't want my kid to go through that. And on a daily basis, I work so hard to make sure they have a better future than mine.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the reflection, and it is good for me. Otherwise, if I were to grow up without all these difficulties, might be could have been even quite difficult for me to know what I want for my life, for myself and for my family.
Yeah.
But because I went through that, it is easy. And more importantly, in this country, we take so many things for granted, yes, you know. And I, on a daily basis, I do talk to a student about this. I normally reflected on my life, my personal life, my personal journey, you know. So this is a good thing for me because I kept the hope alive.
Why I settled in Tasmania.
You are listening to Hobart FM and the life stories of people who are building a new life in Tasmania.
Here on Hobart FM.
How was the life in the refugee camp?
Life in the refugee camp is not an easy life. First of all, you someone who left your country because of war. And when war happened, you lose all your properties, almost everything. And so when we left, we're in refugee camp, we have the basic essentials, which it can be the food, which is provided by the UN. Yes. That was all what we had. Apart from that, we didn't have anything. It was even a struggle to buy clothes. So in a year, we have to work so hard to save some money to buy clothes, to buy books, to buy all what we need. So refugee life, you have nothing completely. You have no right, you know. You cannot do anything. More or less, your life is controlled. We were so much dependent on UNHCR, UN, you know. We have nothing. And if we were to leave the camp and go somewhere, we have to have permission, road permission, a letter which is written to allow you get out of the camp, and you can be given like 2 weeks. So by the time that 2 weeks elapse, you need to be back in the camp. So you can see your life is controlled in a way that you have to have permission from someone to allow you get out of the camp and also back in the camp. Mm. It was a bad experience. And especially when you're growing up.
You were and grow up in the refugee camp in Uganda, but
Uganda was fairly stable. In the camp where we were, yes, there was war going on in the northern part of Uganda. And most refugees who came to Uganda, whether from Congo, from South Sudan, were all settled in the northern part of Uganda. And that's where the Lord resistance they were operating. So we had to sleep in the bush because there could be news that they're coming. Yes, they did come to some of the camps and even abduct people and take them. So it was just life between death and life. So we could sleep in the bush, might be for 2 weeks. It will be stable. When again they get the news, could be the local people around who will just come to the camp and say, these people are coming, the rebels are coming. To escape, we have to go into the bush.
But in your refugee camp, what?
Yes.
Do you remember the name?
I was in a camp called Agodjo Refugee Camp.
Agodjo?
Yes, Agodjo in local language means a rocky place. Oh. A rocky place. So it was full of rocks, you know, who were settled on the rocks.
Okay.
Yes.
Apart of the story of your homeland, what happened after your parents divorced, you grow up, you can't go to the school after that?
After I went to divorce mom, and even the war, the northern part became a little bit disturbed. We had chance through UN, United Nations.
Yes.
What happened, I think, some of the refugees who came to Uganda around 1970s, those our parents
and yes,
other South Sudanese, when they came to Uganda as refugees in 70s, they realized the best they can give their children was the education. So there's nothing they can do but to really build schools. So parents started having meetings. They started collecting stones to build a school.
All right.
First of all, they built grass touch buildings, long one with different rooms, and those were our initial classrooms. But then later on, the United Nations saw that the parents were really interested in providing education for their children through the hard work they've done. UNHCR came in and said, okay, we need to build now a semi-permanent building, Jingru, you know. And so they started providing the bricks, they provided the cements, they provided, the parent collected the stones again. So they started building a proper school. So that's what happened. Then when proper schools were built, we were already, you know, like 20 years or 25. When I finished secondary in Uganda, like 7 years of primary, then 4 years of secondary schools. Then after that, mom could not again send me for further education. And I have some brothers to look after.
Younger than you.
Yes. So I, from my auntie. Auntie died. Mom's sister died when the children were very young. So they were brought up by my mom. And by then, even if I was the last born to my mom, they were still younger than me.
South Sudan has the third biggest oil reserve of Africa and a population of around 11 to 12 million. Almost 4 million people are living without water, not enough food, and in very poor conditions in the refugee camps in Sudan and Uganda.
Decided to join teaching in Uganda was accepted. You start like untrained, they call it untrained teacher. Then after working for 2 years, that was in 1997. I finished secondary in 1995. So after 2 years, I joined teaching. Then after 2 years, I went for training on they call it distant learning. We go to the college during school holidays. And during schools, we were back in the classroom teaching. So it took me 3 years to finish my training. To graduate as a trained primary teacher.
With
a qualification equivalent to high diploma here. That's what happened.
So you became teacher when 28 years, or 29 more or less?
Yeah.
And you got the job?
The good thing, because we are doing training on a job. We have the job. We could just go during holidays to the college.
To the refugee camp.
To the camp to teach. So, yes.
So you become teacher in the refugee camp.
Yes. And I also taught in the same school where, you know, I completed my primary school.
In the stone school.
Yes. So it was so amazing that, you know, I had all this experience of being there and being taught under trees, you know, sitting on the stones. But then by the time I finished secondary, there were already permanent buildings set up by the UN.
UN.
So, and I had the opportunity to come back to the classroom.
As
a teacher in the same school.
Oh, right.
And even to make it really very interesting, some of the teachers who taught us in primary, they were still there. Yes.
They
were still teaching, yes. Teaching in the same school. So we were the young teachers.
Right.
You know, you can see, amazing.
For the new generations.
Even for me, I can just tell you, it was even more amazing. Because my mother-in-law, who taught me in primary, when I came back from secondary, she was my head teacher. She was my principal.
Oh, really?
You can imagine, you know, Your mother-in-law is a principal, and you're a teacher here. You know, what kind of work relationship will you have here?
Okay.
Will you ever, you know, just deal with the teaching, or there has to be some kind of respect in another way because she's my mother-in-law. You know.
Oh, okay.
So, and also, by then we were not yet married, but not officially, but we had already relationship with her daughter.
Ah, you had
and
a daughter.
Her daughter also, after finishing college, she was a high school teacher, came back to teach in the same school. Boyfriend, mother-in-law, girlfriend.
And father.
So it was very interesting.
Ah,
so that was my life.
Okay, so when you become teacher and back to the refugee camp, and yes, you have a relationship and a daughter.
Yes.
What happened with your other siblings or brothers and sisters? They are still there with your mom?
Yes. Then when I got the job, by then was GSHID Refugee Service. They are called GSHID. GSHID Refugees, GRS. They call it GRS.
Yes.
So,
okay.
They were one of the implementing agents. Their work was to provide education, to train teachers,
okay,
and pay the salaries. It wasn't even salaries. It was just token of appreciation, I could call it.
Okay.
The money we get in 1 month, equivalent to $20.
Oh, dear.
That's, you can imagine, someone to spend $20 for 1 month. So it was very interesting. My journey was full of really interest.
How long you were teaching there in the refugee camp?
I started in 1997. From 1997 until 2003, when application was successful, come to Australia.
Did you know something about Australia?
What the people look like there? What language they speak, or something like that?
In a system of Uganda education system, I mean, Uganda system of education, while studying other countries, geography, history as well. So I came to know Australia while studying Australia briefly. One time when we were teaching, I think the Australian people collected pencils, books, they were sent to the refugee camp.
Oh, okay.
And I think because GRS had their main office in Melbourne,
I think they
came and really rally for support, to send books, pencils, you know, to the student. But that's very much when we came to know that, you know, a country, Australia, a continent, through those gifts.
Oh.
And there were letters written by school students from here, and were all sent in a camp, you know.
Oh, right.
Yes. So that was my basic knowledge about Australia. I didn't know much about that, you know.
Okay.
Yes.
And when you decide to apply to come to Australia, did you apply for your wife and daughter, or your mother and brothers and sisters too?
We had a very intensive discussion on that with my family. But then we were not living together with my girlfriend yet. So for me even to go and approach her family to allow us come together, it was even more difficult. It was quite difficult. Very, very difficult.
Why?
Mom refused. Mom said, at her age, if she comes to Australia, she will be asked to go back to school. And it's something that she couldn't manage. She's more than happy to stay in the camp. Then other boys were not ready to come with me. They said they're more than happy to remain. If anything, I might send them form later. But what happened, I have to work, put in the application. I went to my father-in-law, even by then we were not married, father to my girlfriend, request him I could come to Australia with his daughter. He refused.
Oh, really?
He refused.
Why?
Well, very interesting, because marriage in Africa, sometimes their parents were very strict. They want their daughter to marry from the same clan. So,
and she was in the same clan of you?
No. Having come from a different clan was actually an obstacle to our marriage.
Oh, dear.
We had very, very good relationship with my girlfriend, even with my mother-in-law, mother to my girlfriend. But her dad refused. And I remember I went back and I was so upset, really. I couldn't sleep that night because I realized someone I had in my life for 10 years.
It was after 10 years.
10 years. We went primary school from grade 5. When in the same class, we went along. She went to a different secondary. I went to a different secondary schools, but very close together. We kept that love. She went to the college to train as a secondary teacher. I went to a different college. But because we had such a lovely relationship and a long-time relationship, I feel I couldn't, you know, getting into another relationship could even be really tougher.
Yes.
But I thought this is someone who had been in my life, you know, and I couldn't go and leaving her. So my intention is to go to her dad and, you know, have that request pass on.
So what did you did?
He refused the first time. I didn't go the second time. But in his head, my girlfriend decided to come and live with me.
Oh.
Decided to move
to live
from
with
her parent to live with me. To make things, whether that wanted or not. But the good thing, my mother-in-law, we had her support, a complete support.
Oh, you okay.
Know? And she said, for me, if a girl, you know, chose to be with who she want to be, after all, she's a grown-up now, she has to. I think she convinced that to my girlfriend to say, it's okay, they can go, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that's how. So when she came and lived with me, it was even before we put in the application.
Okay.
Yes. Then we were officially living together, and after the application, our application was accepted. When my father-in-law refused daughter to come with me, I have to call my brother here. And I told him, look, my wife Teddy is not going to come with me because that her dad refused. And his suggestion was, can I cross her name off from the application form?
Really?
Oh, I said, leave it with me. That day, my head was like, really? I was going through really tough time, headache, because of what was happening.
Uh-huh.
Then I called him. I said, can you call me in the morning? He called me the next day, and I said, no, I made the decision. We're coming together.
Mm. All right.
Because he's the sponsor.
Ah,
yes.
Okay.
So,
so you need the sponsor to come, even if you
yes.
come from the refugee
yes.
camp?
There are people who come whose application has been successful, and they are to be sponsored by the government,
okay.
depending on your case. But in our case, because I have already my elder brother here to propose us to come, he is definitely the sponsor here.
Ah, uh-huh, okay.
Yes.
Right.
It was even very important that when you have someone to sponsor you, you make the process, application process, quite easily.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't take long like other people. Others had been 20 years, 10 years in the camp, keep trying.
Mm.
And with the corruption, sometimes even if your application is successful, I get back to the UN office or humanitarian office in Kenya, they hide it. They can't even tear it and throw it in a bin.
Yeah, right.
Yes, because both Kenyan government and Uganda did not want refugees to leave their countries
yes.
to come to Australia. They know there's a better life here. And they will start losing that funding from the UN, United Nations. Because for them to settle refugees, they are obviously funding from UN
of
to the
course.
Country. So they did not want to lose that.
Anna Taban, dedicated to all South Sudanese and the people who lost a family member in this youth-led war. A group of South Sudanese musicians, artists, and activists recently released a song and music video called Anna Taban. In Arabic, it means I am tired.
The group, which includes musicians, painters, poets, actors, and activists from South Sudan and Kenya, met in September last year in Kenya's Lake Elementaita for a peace conference and created the song.
جنوبين كل يوم موت موت لمتين يا اخوانا نقول سلام سلام متين السلام ده يجي يلدونا في هروب ونربي في هروب وكمان نموت في هروب لكل جنوبي يموت قطعة من جنوبنا بيموت نجري لمتين ولوين ندي يالنا وندي أرواحنا وندي دمنا فضل شنو تاني أنا تعبان
أنا ما شابان لكن أنا بس تعبان أنا ما فرحان لكن أنا بس فتران أنا ما سكران لكن أنا بس كسران
and I'm a Catalan. Black in Anabesta.
Sankey with that beat.
Wehedo salama through the kumakum ya vijunukda. Selai kun haja muadini maishufya. Binia bonjoz ya bahabuba hajad mabeba vijunukda. Gabriya jua, unzuriya jua, karehiya jua, gaba kapi jua, fazan jua. Nyaga mahajata nas jua. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Ooyah. Those plush RPG, the baba's bazooka. Jerry Jerry, Libertan, Juno Bing, ID, Fika, Pala, Nairobi, UN, America, Australia, Spain. Hey, Ruku, Tadunia, Juno B, C, Leo, Belatana, Thala. No wisdom. Why sound the gun? Redundant. Like a head song. I'm feeling so tired. Anatawan fun.
Anatawan mean Jerry Jerry. Talgamala watcha, talgamala watcha. Usawa saka bat na jian, anataban. Bashakil karabu bele, tali nuru bia fapele.
Mot pot kulu yom, si telephone, junuk tanina karabu, nina malu. Dom kubu, aku ya wakatulu, anataban, anataban, fishuno.
Alamu watiri, junu bivesi.
Listening to
Why I Settled in Tasmania.
The living stories of people from refugee backgrounds who have settled in the Apple Isle.
Here on Hobart FM.
Your brother was settled here in Tasmania when he came in 2001.
Yes.
After your application was successful, can tell us how was your journey from the refugee camp to Australia?
Sonia, that probably was the best ever time in my life, the happiest time in my life. So when I got the call that my application was successful, of course, we live in a village. We have to take a bus from the nearby town, which is Adjumani, to come to Kampala. Because the immigration office in the capital city of Uganda. So it's 1 day journey by bus from the village to the capital city, Kampala, to come and find out about our application. So when we came, they said, yes, now you have to go through medical check. So even our application was successful, we have to wait for the visa to be sent. To then my brother has now to book a flight for us. So, and it has to be done in a way that, so it wasn't even easy for him, because he has to work hard to send that money. I was so excited, given that I was leaving camp, but again, on the other end, was so sad, because I was leaving my family members. I was leaving my best friends, you know. I was leaving the teachers I worked with, the student I love so much that I normally stand up on a daily basis and give them lessons. It was sad. But then, on the other hand, I feel there will be future for my children. And having children is part of our family life. Someone without children is looked at as, you know, you're not really a member of society. Having children means a respect, you know, a respect, and you are a member of that community. So, yes, it was very exciting.
Your family, your mother and brothers and sisters, are still in the refugee camps?
Yes.
And your parents in law too?
Unfortunately, 2 weeks when we left the camp, we came to Australia. He was sick, became sick, a stroke, you know, was suffering from a stroke.
Your father-in-law?
Yeah, father-in-law. He died 1 month later. That was even really very hard time for us. And when we came here, we thought we could have our children, we could have started having family and children, because he was going through that trauma, you know, dad died, and this is the life we're in. It wasn't easy for her really to settle. That was a sad part of our journey to Australia. We knew one day things will be better for us. We believe that, you know, anything that has a beginning would definitely one day have an end. We arrived 2003, October the 7th. We took 2 days to come to Australia.
And do you have any particular experience or memory about the journey from Uganda to Australia?
Oh, yes. From South Africa, we have to wait in the airport for 4 hours. And it was even tough, because we realized we did not change Uganda money into Australian dollar. We couldn't even buy anything. We have the Ugandan shillings money, but we cannot buy anything. You know, we were so hungry for 4 hours in the airport. Then finally said, yes, time for boarding. We have to go. We get on to the plane and we came to Perth. It was a long journey, you know. And the first experience of being on such a plane was amazing, but then was even more scared. You know, we haven't... we had been on a plane once when we were being moved from one refugee camp to another part of Uganda. So the UN provided that. But it was a different plane. Plane without seats. I think for carrying, you know, goods and, you know, wasn't meant for carrying human beings. So, yeah, that was tiring, because even in the plane, we're not used to the food that they provide. You know, it was like salad and this and that. We didn't like it.
Even that you were hungry?
Absolutely. We needed something better than that, which never happened, because we didn't know things like salad. Why are they bringing all this? You know? So it was a very interesting game.
So, and how was when you arrived in Hobart?
Amazing. But someone too was cold. Even October here, but this time could be warm.
Oh, yes.
It was too cold for us. Really, we can't even sleep. Even when you cover with a blanket, you can. But the good thing, my brother, through the church support group, the Reformed Church in Kingston, provided a ready house with 2 bedrooms house for us.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was stocked. Everything was free and everything. So we came that night briefly. We went to my brother's house. Yes, life was completely different. you know, having seen, you know, the light when we were driving, and was good to be in the car being driven, and you know, you can just realize, oh, we're out of refugee camp. So it was good. But then settlement was another thing. Difficult, very difficult. Even if we were teachers, is the way people pronounce things. Australian way of saying something was difficult.
Did you know some English before you come here?
I did.
Okay.
Uganda system of education provide like 7 years of primary English.
But so, even like that was hard for you when you arrived here?
It was still hard. Because the way we pronounce things, many you know, they go and said, sorry, you know, they want you to say it again because they didn't get you. So that was another aspect of life we struggled with. We knew I'm someone who could speak quite fluent, but more frequent, and it get people difficult to understand me. It make it very difficult for someone to understand because I speak so quickly, you know. And with all that pronunciation, you know, Uganda was more British kind of education. So,
but you speak very well.
I tried the same, you know, centering, you know, migrant resource center. So people listen to us, and sometimes they do not understand what we're saying, you know.
And do you understand them?
We could understand them, but again, if they speak Australian way of saying things, it can be really very difficult. Yes, we normally tell them, we said, can you speak a little bit slowly, please, so that we really get what you're saying. So that's how some of the difficulties we went through.
So you went to study English in TAFE or the
yes,
Polytechnic?
Yes, we did. We came in 2003, October, and it was almost toward the end of the year. So we went to TAFE. It was lovely, a place to really start. You learn social life, socializing with the other friends, you know, meeting other members of not only our community, but across.
In a few seconds, we'll be with Joseph from South Sudan
in Hobart, Tasmania.
And where was your first job here in Australia?
I was so lucky. Step was a service provider's agent here, yeah? Steps.
Oh, right.
So they came and they said, okay, we're going to open a restaurant for African in Hobart. It was called Afrites, African Tasmanian. And we were the first group who were, but then trained for 5 weeks. Then I started working in a restaurant. It was a hard thing, really, to do, because I think it was just the system of education we were brought up in, that education was meant for white-collar job, you know, being in the office and working in the big offices. But when we came to Tasmania, it was even very hard for me to accept to be a waiter, you know, in a restaurant, given my background in education, a teacher. I struggled with that. You know, why should I become a waiter when I was a teacher? You know, so it was very interesting. But then when we started the work, after 5 weeks training,
yes,
we started to work in a restaurant, 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 months, I started now understanding Australian workforce here, you know?
Yes.
And I became so interested. And working in the restaurant actually provided me really the avenue to really look at things and also change my mind. You know, even though I was a teacher, but now working in a restaurant, and most Australians don't look at any work as a bad work, you know. So that's why I came to learn that every job in Australia, paying job in Australia, even volunteering, it's very important. So I worked in a restaurant for 7 months, was so far the best job ever I had in my life. You meet people, very friendly people, and when you serve them well, they give you tips. And by then our tips were collected and, you know, put, by the end of the day, they give us all. You know, every night I go home with some coins in my pocket.
Okay.
Was ever the best job I had, you know. So after 7 months, we were approached by a Department of Education. Given our background in education, they said, okay, are you and your wife interested to take some training? We did teacher aid training certificate too.
Okay.
Yes. Because there was really need for teacher aid or teacher assistant. And my wife and I feel that since we had that background and we are pretty much educated, we could be an asset to our own community. We should be helping our own community. So we did... We did training. It was for 6 months at TAFE. Then, when we finished, job was ready for us. We were ready to be employed in the school.
So your wife is teacher too?
Yes, but it was difficult. Looking at, I was thinking as an African man, how can I go and work in the school among white Australians? Will I be accepted? You know. So I was struggling, to, you know, with all this feeling. But some of the school we were employed in were the best school. I went to Lansdowne Crescent in West Hobart. And by then, the principal was Peter Mamion, was ever the best man that I met in Australia. This is the man who lived that side of the country, like Blackman Bay or Sydney. He could come and pick me up in the morning. We didn't have car, and I didn't even know how to catch the bus. He could pick me up, take me to work, and when we finished, and he was someone really who wanted to change my life. Even if he had some time work to do in the office after his schools, he will say, no, I can drop you home. He could drop me home. So that's how we started working in the schools. After all that years, what it was actually when I left working at the restaurant, then we were thinking I can go to uni now and do some more training. Yeah, even if we had certificate two in education or teacher assistant, I was accepted. At university, but it was even more hard work
because, yes, of course,
the language was completely different, and my level of education, even if I had that level of education, was probably not really good enough to make me go through uni so quickly. I struggled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how my work related experience came about.
Did you did the bachelor in education?
Unfortunately, there was no one really guide me through what I want to do, what I'm interested doing. So I went to uni, but I went to uni, I didn't finish yet. Because I was nearly finishing, then I lost my mom.
Right.
Yes. When I lost my mom, I lost direction completely.
She was still in the refugee camp?
Yes. So it became so sad for me. And it took me like 4 years to recover from that. Given I'm here and my mom, whom I'm supposed to go and see, and even said, thank you for giving me all that life. You struggle, but... I am where I am today because of you. I did not have chance to go and tell mom this, and it was so painful.
So you didn't see her after you left Uganda?
No. So that was the sad part. Then later on, So applied early this year. We'll be doing some unit. Left with 3 units to finish. Only 3, you know.
All right.
So, yes, I'm doing arts degree, which is majoring in sociology and gender studies.
All right.
I became so interested because of, you know, how our community or society, African community, is, you know, the balance between the women and men.
Yes.
Right, even in the family, from different perspective. You know, back in Africa, a man, you know, is the head of a family, breadwinner, whereas a woman is considered. But now I came to Australia. I want to look at that difference.
So you are working as a primary school teacher.
Yes.
When did you become father? And how many children you have now?
In 2000, 5 kids. It's even quite difficult. We need to get bigger car. Having children for us, culturally, is a dignity. And we look at children as a gift, as gifts from God. So the context of our culture, having children and family, is a respect.
You are living in Tasmania for
14 years.
So why do you decide to stay here in Tasmania, Joseph?
I think there are so many reasons. I came direct to Tasmania because I got family here. It was more easy for me to come and settle. We also have our own ideas with my wife, what we want in life. We knew we will have family, children. Looking back, reflecting back on our life when we were young, we wanted the best for our kids. I'm always with the opinion that a small place like Tasmania is good for upbringing of kids. Good to provide education, good for kids to settle. For us, we look at it, as young as they are, it is good for us to stay in Tasmania, to live in Tasmania.
Okay.
Until it might be when they become grown up, we chose to live in Tasmania.
Mm-hmm.
We have, Tasmania is more community, small community. And so, yes, we feel this is a place our kids can grow in, and we can really provide education for them. Well, it's difficult to get job. I can understand. But it's good for me to see my kids go to school and having the best education and live in an amazing, you know, beautiful place like Tasmania.
How many languages do you speak? What is your mother tongue?
It's Acholi.
Uh-huh, Acholi. Where this language come from?
The Luo. The Luo tribe originally migrated from Barat Kazal in South Sudan.
Right.
And came into Uganda, and along the way they intermarried with the local people.
Yes.
In Uganda we have Acholi in the north. Then we have the Alur. Yes. My wife is a Madi, M-A-D-I.
Yes.
She speaks completely different language, Arabic and English, Madi. And she has also learned to speak Acholi.
Oh, okay.
She's very fluent in my language.
All right.
And the notion of learning the language is, like, I don't want my in-laws to be saying things against me. And if I don't learn her language, they could be saying things against me.
Yeah.
You know? So that's one way of learning it. A bit of Swahili, too.
And what language do you speak with your kids at home?
We speak Acholi, which is my language. We also speak Arabic and English.
The three of them?
They should be growing multilingual.
In 40 years, how do you experience discrimination here?
Well, I believe in any society, whether I was, you know, I was to be in my own country, I will experience some kind of discrimination, whether at workplace or whether in the street. So when we came to Tasmania, we knew it was not going to be easy for us, given we are African, and now we go into a white-dominated community or society.
Yes.
Will they be able to accept us the way we are? Some will accommodate us, others may not. And this is where sometimes on the street you meet people calling you by all sort of names. But I think for us, we knew sometime people, the Australians who had lived in this country for a long, long time and haven't been to other country has a limited knowledge when it comes to people from different backgrounds. Obviously, someone like that have limited experience having seen someone from a different country coming. You get this. When I was at uni, one time applied for work, to go and work in salad factory in Cambridge.
Yes.
I put in my application, and I was picking cherries at Yundu. It was summertime. Someone came from the office and said, "Good, we got your application. Can we come for interview?" I think there was two Joseph. There were two Joseph. Joseph David, Joseph Massimo was the office in Mona. Vimex, looking at this African man entering my office, he refused. He said he did not call me. He totally refused. And I have to show him the evidence. And I said, "This is your phone number. He called me using this mobile phone number." Yeah. And I knew he did not want me for that job. But because he made mistake,
yes,
and he has to accept it. But do you know what happened afterward?
What?
They put so much pressure on me. Because I was studying at uni, I told them, I have 3 days that I can work, but the rest of other days I have to do uni stuff, you know, study.
Yes.
They put so much pressure. They call me every day, sometimes at 1 a.m. I have to go to work, you know. I worked for 3 months. To let me leave the job was to put so much pressure on me. Even when working, sometimes you meet drunk people who don't like African men. They say things that you don't like. But then, to me personally, I deal with it. I focus more on a positive life than spending so much time on a negative one. Because even my experience, being a refugee camp is tougher than that. Why should I give chance to somebody saying things against me? I look at it as, you know, these are all rubbish, I move on. Well, they want you to report it. The discrimination, anti-discrimination want you to report that. Probably the process will even take longer than he expected. And what does it mean? If it takes, like, for instance, two months for somebody to get back to me and say, "We have dealt with this," what about that period? Would I still be very upset with myself or very angry to someone? No, never.
And how do you manage this with your kids and your wife? Do you talk about that in your home?
We do. I explain being African Australian, it's not going to be easy, but we need to grow up. They need to grow up very close to their life, because this is the place they can, the best place they can grow in. I feel more of African because of my heritage, right, where I came from, and because I still have connection with where I came from.
Right.
And that is still, you know, very much on my life on a daily basis.
Right.
And I feel more Australian because I'm a citizen now. But again, many people said, we come here, we have a freedom to do everything. But then this freedom comes with responsibilities. As a citizen, what are my responsibilities? To respect the law, to contribute to the economy of the country. I have to work hard.
It's annoying for you if the people ask you, still after 14 years living in Australia, where you come from?
Yeah, they do.
But it's annoying for you?
I said I come from Tasmania. they do. In Kingston, where we were settled, we are settled. I think we have that questions every morning. It's a common thing with Australians. To start a conversation with you, they ask something like that. Many start with the weather. How is the weather? Do you like the weather? What we did, we said, no, we are local people here. And we're tired of all these question every morning when we going to school. So we applied for grant, and they were very supportive. The Kingborough Council applied for grant. We had yearly festival, and in that festival we introduced ourselves and we said, when you see us around, we're local people now.
Right.
You need to know that we live here, we have our children here. And in Kingston, they became aware that, oh, we have these people here, we have students here. You know, it was easy for them to understand where we came from and where we now live.
Right.
You know, that reduces the question, every morning question of where did you come from? are you a student? And things like that. And I guess we did the right thing. It was really the first of its kind. And we had for like 3 years, such event for 3 years. Okay. Later on it was moved to Hobart because many people from Glenorchy find it difficult to go to Kingston. Kingston was taken as a very far
away
place to go to.
Okay, Jose, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Sonia.
Next week, join us to listen to another fascinating story
from the Karen, Oromo, South Sudanese, Ugandan, Nepalese, Hazara, and Rwandan communities.
Here on Hobart FM.